Okay, hello everybody, and welcome to the last of the February teleclass series. It's my great pleasure and privilege to host this class. My name is Martin Kiernan, and I'm a nurse consultant in infection prevention in the UK. Today's teleclass is going to be presented by Phil Stewart. Phil's a professor of chemical and biological engineering at Montana State University. Having worked in Switzerland, he gained his doctorate at Stanford University before working in Paris and then California. After joining the Centre for Biofilm Engineering, he became its third director in 2005. The centre celebrated its 20th anniversary back in 2010. The outputs from the centre are increasing all the time. By 2006, the centre was averaging 40 papers a year, still increasing, and 52 publications came from the centre in 2011. Phil's got specific areas of expertise, but mainly he's going to be talking to us today about biofilm control in chronic wounds, so we look forward to hearing this. Thank you, Phil.
And thank you, Martin. It's really my pleasure to be able to speak with you today about the biofilm hypothesis of chronic infection. And I thought to start with, I would actually give a couple of examples of classical acute infections by way of contrast with the stories you'll hear about the paradigm of biofilm infection. So on the second slide, you see a reference to bubonic plague, the Black Death that ravaged Europe in the Middle Ages, disease caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis. And here a quote from an Italian observer who noted that victims ate lunch with their friends and dinner with their ancestors in paradise. So tying to the very swift, lethal course of this infection. And here's a second example in the next slide, cholera, caused by the bacterium Vibrio cholera. A 19th century English observer remarked, "What frightened people about cholera was the speed at which it struck the victim and brought about a painful death." So again, very quick-moving, life-threatening infections, both caused by very specific individual bacteria. And when we switch to the biofilm here, we'll find that the course of the infection is really quite different. On the next slide, you'll see a microscope image of a staphylococcal biofilm grown in our labs. And I just want to talk about this for a moment to help you appreciate, first of all, what a biofilm is, if this is new to you, and the complexity of the organization here. So biofilms are microbes that have usually attached to a surface and are growing in very dense aggregates. And that's what you're seeing here. These yellowish-green clusters are not actually individual bacteria. They are microcolonies, each composed of hundreds or thousands even of staph cells. And they're all held together by a highly hydrated, usually rather invisible, extracellular matrix, and the red staining here is revealing at least some of that matrix, a mixture of polysaccharides, proteins, and even nucleic acids. And you can, I think you can appreciate from this image that this is a multicellular structure with a lot of organization and a lot of bacteria that are in close proximity and highly organized. Well, let's move to the next slide, and I'd like to give you a couple of descriptions of what we regard as biofilm infections. And the first one here is about a device-associated infection. This image that you see here is the pacemaker lead. It's a wire that came out of a man who experienced repeated bouts of septicemia. Staph bacteria were cultured from his blood. He was admitted to the hospital, put on very aggressive intravenous antibiotic therapy, and he would get better and be discharged. And a week later, he was back with fever, tenderness in the upper chest, chills, and hospitalized again. And they actually went through three rounds of relapsing infection and the IV antibiotics before just going in and surgically removing the entire pacing unit. And what they're able to find is that this pacemaker lead in particular was encrusted with biofilm. And if we advance to the next slide here that zooms in, you can actually see the staphylococci piled up like so many ball bearings on the surface of a wire. So these are the classic sequelae of a biofilm infection. It can be slow-moving, but it's very difficult to resolve. Responds transiently to antibiotics, perhaps, but usually recurs. And one of the only sure ways to resolve such an infection is actually to remove the implanted catheter, hip joint, whatever piece of plastic or metal the biofilm has used as a foothold to set up shop. Here's another widely accepted example of a biofilm infection. This one doesn't involve a piece of implanted plastic or metal. This is a biofilm that forms in the lungs of individuals with cystic fibrosis. So here there is a genetic defect in a chloride ion channel that makes the body secretions salty, makes the mucus in the lung thick, and tips the balance in the lung a little bit in favor of the bacteria and allows the lung to become essentially permanently colonized with biofilm bacteria. So in individuals with CF, once they have bacteria in their lungs, they're never cleared despite very aggressive inhaled antibiotic therapy. Often it's clear that the body's host defenses are active. See evidence of a massive invasion of white blood cells, of neutrophils, and the unfortunate consequence of that, of the body going on the attack against the biofilm, is that these phagocytes are also unable to get their teeth around the biofilm, unable to kill the biofilm, and they do collateral damage to neighboring healthy tissue as they spit out proteases and reactive oxygen species. In the CF lung, there's evidence for bacteria in low oxygen, even anaerobic niches, anaerobic metabolism, and that's also going to be a recurrent theme in these biofilm infections. The next example on the next slide is a biofilm below the gum line. This is periodontitis, and you see in this image here the chronic inflammation associated with periodontitis. Here, the tooth surface is presumably providing that relatively poorly defended surface that the biofilm has set up shop on. Here again, antibiotics and antiseptic mouth rinses have limited efficacy. And there's really a stalemate set up between the biofilm, bacteria in the biofilm, and the host that is smoldering along and causing this inflammation and progressive bone loss. Eventually, teeth fall out if this is untreated. Malodor is one of the features of this infection and also a good sign of anaerobic microbial activity. On the next slide, you see a venous stasis ulcer, a type of chronic wound. These are open sores that stay open for weeks or months or even longer, and there's mounting evidence that they're colonized by biofilm. And here again, the biofilm is probably forming on pockets of necrotic tissue where the host has a hard time delivering its natural defense. The symptoms, such as the size of the wound, pain, exudate, can wax and wane over periods of weeks to months. So slow motion, but kind of a stasis. Here again, we find that topical antimicrobials and systemic antibiotics have only a marginal effect, and it's clear that the normal healing process is arrested. Malodor is also one of the very troublesome, stigmatizing consequences of some of these chronic wounds. And moving to the next slide, one more example, biofilm in chronic osteomyelitis. And the image that you're looking at here shows a staphylococcal biofilm. That's the top part of the image. This is a transmission electron microscope image, where the little round, spherical dark dots are actually individual staph bacteria, and then the white area at the bottom here is a bit of dead bone. Again, that poorly defended surface that the biofilm can access and colonize and then be very tenacious. This is actually a post-mortem sample that came from a man who injured his leg as a teenager. So he acquired this infection, he was treated throughout, I think, over many years with antibiotics, and he died at age 64. I don't think it had any, his death had anything to do with the osteomyelitis, but the biofilm outlived him. You know, it's still there decades later on this dead bone at the site of the infection. One of the things that can happen in osteomyelitis is that the body, in its attempt to wall off the infection, can encapsulate the site in fibrous tissue, decreasing vascularization, and essentially building a fortress that the biofilm is camped out in. So just to summarize these features on the next slide, biofilms tend to form preferentially on foreign bodies, piece of plastic or metal, a catheter, a contact lens, an artificial knee. But they can also form on dead or damaged tissue. But one of the unifying themes here is that there's some compromised surface that allows the biofilm to become established. These are often slow-moving infections, but they're persistent. They lead to chronic infections and disease. They respond poorly or only transiently to antibiotic and antiseptic therapy. Rarely these can cure an infection, a biofilm infection. Most of the time the infection relapses. A common feature here is collateral damage to neighboring healthy tissue. And again, this may be partly due to the host's own futile attempt to clear the biofilm. And another feature is the presence of anoxic niches at the microscale in the biofilm, anaerobic metabolism, and indeed the presence in some of these situations of strict anaerobes, for example, in periodontitis and also in chronic wounds. So that is a summary of what I think are consensus features of biofilm infections, and what I would like to turn to now is a discussion of a little bit of the science behind why these biofilms are so hard to kill with antimicrobials for a little bit more insight. And so on the next, one more commentary slide. The next slide shows a couple of creatures and is meant to give you one more alternative way of thinking about the difference between a planktonic acute infection, again, bubonic plague, for example, and a biofilm infection. And one way to think about the acute infection is as a predatory, swift-striking, potentially fatal, certainly life-threatening attack on the host, whereas the biofilm is more like a parasite that is setting up shop. It's taking a slow toll on the host, but it's in for the long haul, presumably feeding off nutrients in that local environment and spending quite a while there. Okay. Now, on the next slide, we're turning to the lab. So we're going in vitro here. And this slide depicts one of the laboratory flow cell systems that we use to study biofilms. And so the biofilm in this experiment is growing in a glass tube under continuous flow conditions, and the glass tube actually has a square cross-section. So what we can do is bring a microscope objective down to the ceiling of that tube, and using confocal scanning laser microscopy, we can look right inside the biofilm and ask questions about what's happening. And the first question we're going to address is whether antimicrobials or antibiotics can penetrate into the biofilm. And here's on the next slide an example of a Staphylococcus epidermidis biofilm grown in one of these capillary tubes. This is just a low magnification transmission image. The tube is about a millimeter across, and those large dark blotches are dense clusters of staph bacteria biofilm hanging off the ceiling or sidewall of the tube. If we go inside one of those clusters at much higher magnification, about two orders of magnitude zoomed in here, and this is by transmission electron microscopy, now we can see the individual staph bacterial cells. These are the dark spheroids, and also that faintly stained grayish material in between the cells. That's the normally highly hydrated matrix material that's gluing the structure together. One of the things I like about this image is that it resembles quite a bit the staph biofilm in that osteomyelitis example that we saw several slides ago. So at the microscale, the in vivo biofilm, the in vitro biofilm look quite a bit alike. All right. Here's one of the techniques that we've used to actually watch the action of an antimicrobial agent against a biofilm in this system. What we're doing here, so we're on the slide entitled Visualizing Antimicrobial Action. What we're doing here is to preload the bacteria with a green fluorescent dye. We do this with a staining substrate called calcium AM or CAM, and without going through the specifics, what it does is to generate inside the cell a green fluorescent, multiply charged molecule. It's not bound to anything, but because it's multiply charged, it is trapped inside the hydrophobic cell membrane. And as long as the cell membrane remains intact, the cell will hold on to most of that green color. If we come along with an antimicrobial agent that permeabilizes the cell, we can see that in the loss of green color. And on the next slide, you'll see a sequence of a treatment in this flow cell system with a quaternary ammonium compound, very common industrial and consumer product disinfectant, commonly just called quats. I usually show these as movies, and they're I think they're quite compelling as movies. And if you have access to the journal Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy, you can go online and see, view some of these movies in the supplementary online material. What you're looking at here in each of these panels is an overlay of the transmission image in grayscale or black and white, and then a much thinner confocal slice showing where in green, showing you where the bacteria have been loaded with this green dye. So this is a very heavily fouled section of the capillary tube. This is kind of only a thin zone down the middle center of the capillary that's open, and flows from left to right. And as this quaternary ammonium biocide is introduced into the flow cell under flowing conditions, you can see a distinctive pattern of green fluorescence loss over 10 or 20 minutes. There's actually still a little green in these images that's hard for your eye to pick up. One of the things you can't see in the stills that you can see in the movie is that the biofilm twitches around in the flow. And it's a nice reminder that these are rubbery, viscoelastic structures. But one of the things that you can definitely appreciate here is that this treatment doesn't remove any of the biofilm. All the cells are still there. And so even if the clot has compromised the membrane integrity of many or even most of these cells, the few survivors are still stuck. They're still there, and they're going to grow back very quickly and repopulate this biofilm with viable bacteria. On the next slide, you see a sequence that shows a treatment with a very aggressive concentration of chlorine. This is hypochlorous acid at neutral pH. And here you see a very different pattern. If you'll just focus on the 20-minute panel in the center of the slide here, what you can see is that the chlorine is knocking out the green color in a thin zone around the periphery of the cell cluster. In other words, it's not penetrating all the way. And this is consistent with other measurements we've done. The biofilm is like a reactive sponge. Chlorine is a reactive oxidant, and the chlorine is being neutralized by reactions with the organic matter in the biofilm out at the surface layers of the biofilm faster than it can diffuse in. So this sets up a very effective protective defense for something like hypochlorous acid. And, of course, hypochlorous acid is one of the key reactive oxygen species that neutrophils use to target bacteria. The other thing you can notice happening with chlorine is that there is some erosion of the biofilm. This is one of the few treatments that we see any removal of the biofilm. So we think that the chlorine is actually attacking the mechanical integrity, the cohesion of the biofilm matrix, again, just around the edge of that cell cluster, and causing it, that weakened biomass, to be stripped off by the flow. All right. If we move to the next slide, you'll see, again, a sequence with an antimicrobial peptide called nisin. This is used in food preservation, and it's an analog of the antimicrobial peptides that animals and humans use as part of our innate immune defense. And what you see when we treat the biofilm with nisin is that it enters the biofilm and within 5 or 10 minutes very uniformly knocks out most of the green color. Again, it doesn't remove any of the biomass. So this is really a compelling demonstration that the size of the antimicrobial is probably not the key determinant of whether it penetrates. Nisin is order of magnitude 1,000 molecular weight. In fact, I think it's a couple thousand. So it's about two orders of magnitude bigger in terms of molecular weight than hypochlorous acid, yet it penetrates quite readily. And that's because it's not reactive. It's not being neutralized as fast enough to slow it down. So it moves in just according to the physics of diffusion, and that time scale is several minutes. On the next slide, we're going to switch to a little different experiment. It's the same flow cell with a staph biofilm growing in it, but here the chemists at Cubist have taken their antibiotic, daptomycin, and attached a green fluorescent tag to it. And what we're going to do now is just run this tagged antibiotic into the flow cell and watch whether it can penetrate into the center of one of these biofilm cell clusters. So on the next slide, we see a sequence of daptomycin penetration in a biofilm. The upper left-hand panel there is, again, a transmission image, and if you just sort of focus on that isolated cell cluster that's in the middle of that flow channel, what you see is that when the daptomycin, it's tagged with a green fluorophore, is introduced into the flow cell, it surrounds that cell cluster, it fills the fluid with bright fluorescence, and then it starts to move on into the center of that cell cluster. And within 90 seconds or 2 minutes, the cluster kind of disappears because it's just been completely permeated by the fluorescent drug. The lower right-hand panel is, again, a transmission image showing you that the cluster is still there. There hasn't been any disturbance of the structure. So this is a very nice demonstration that an antibiotic can penetrate even the very large, dense staph cell cluster within a few minutes. It's quick enough that it almost surely doesn't contribute to the defense, the tolerance of the biofilm to killing by an agent like this. So on the next slide, we'll see a schematic diagram of another technology for measuring penetration. This is a microelectrode, a very fine needle-shaped sensor, the tip of which has been engineered to detect a particular chemical species. In this case, it's going to be hydrogen peroxide. And what we've done in this experiment is to grow a biofilm on a slide in a different reactor system and then move it into this open flow cell. And we're using two microelectrodes. One is positioned right down at the base of the biofilm, about just 10 microns off the stainless steel slide that the biofilm was grown on, and we leave it there. The second microelectrode is positioned directly above that spot in the fluid flowing over the biofilm, and we leave it there. And now, when we run a hydrogen peroxide solution into the system, we can simultaneously record in real time what's being delivered to the top of the biofilm and what's actually making it down to the bottom of the biofilm. And on the next slide, you see a graph that shows an example of this experiment. This is hydrogen peroxide concentration versus time. At time zero, we're introducing 50 millimolar hydrogen peroxide into the system. And the red trace you see there labeled bulk fluid is showing you what we're detecting up in the water running across the top of the biofilm. And the black trace that skids along the x-axis there, labeled base of biofilm, is showing you that, in fact, we're detecting very little of anything at all, very little hydrogen peroxide at all, down at the base of this thin, watery biofilm. At about 3,200 seconds in this experiment, we pulled that lower electrode up into the bulk fluid just to make sure the darn thing is working, and we get a spike up to anticipated signal level so that the electrode's working. The hydrogen peroxide is not penetrating. And here again we have an example of a small antimicrobial, 34 molecular weight, that is not making it in. And the explanation here is right there in the center of the slide. These bacteria, like many others, make enzymes, catalases, that degrade and completely neutralize hydrogen peroxide. So hydrogen peroxide can diffuse around in the watery biofilm just fine, but the biofilm is like a reactive sponge. It's neutralizing hydrogen peroxide out in the surface layers faster than it can diffuse in. If you think about this, this reaction is not energy dependent, so even if the cells on the front line of the biofilm get hammered by the hydrogen peroxide and die, as long as they stay attached to the biofilm, they can still carry out this enzymatic reaction and continue to protect their more deeply embedded cousins. So you could think of this perhaps as a sacrificial, kind of altruistic defense. So on the next slide, we're just summarizing a couple of points about antimicrobial penetration, and I would say that in my judgment at this point that antibiotics, most if not all antibiotics, and likewise antimicrobial peptides, again, components of the host innate immune system, probably penetrate biofilms fairly readily and within seconds or minutes. Whereas reactive oxidants such as halogens and hydrogen peroxide may in fact fail to penetrate because of a reaction-diffusion interaction. And so at this point, I'd like to kind of turn to, we've got one explanation for why hypochlorous acid or hydrogen peroxide might not work very well, but we don't have an explanation for why an antibiotic can't cure a biofilm infection. So I want to think about the biology behind that defense. And I'm going to switch here on the next slide to a different experimental system that we call the colony biofilm. Now, this is simply a porous membrane that's set down on a petri dish and spotted with a drop of the organism we're working with. Those bacteria grow up into a mound on top of the membrane, and every day we pick the membrane and colony biofilm up with a peristeral forceps and move it to a new plate to provide some fresh nutrients. And after a couple of days, we have a very dense aggregate of bacteria in a hydrated matrix. I'll show you that they're just about bulletproof when it comes to antibiotics. In other words, this system captures many of the characteristics of other biofilms. You might think of this as a primitive model for the biofilm in a chronic wound, for example, where the auger you could think about as the host tissue, a source of carbon and nitrogen. The membrane might be a surrogate for a bit of necrotic tissue. And then we have the biofilm growing at this air interface with oxygen coming from one side of the biofilm and carbon and nitrogen and other nutrients coming from the other side of the biofilm. And on the next slide, you see just a picture of a Staphylococcus aureus colony biofilm, 3 days old, grown on a blood auger plate, so it makes for a colorful image. But what I want you to take from this is that these don't look like just a colony on a petri dish. After 3 days, the colony biofilm is bumpy, glistening, variegated, and it's pretty tough. On the next slide, you see an example of an antibiotic challenge against this. In this case, it's a 2-day-old Staphylococcus epidermidis biofilm. So the y-axis here is a measure of viable bacteria on a log scale. And the open symbols labeled planktonic are just a kind of a conventional test tube test of the killing by this drug rifampin, which is one of the best drugs against these biofilms. And this shows that this strain of Staph epi is very well controlled by rifampin. We get a 5-log reduction. That's 100,000-fold reduction in the number of viable bacteria within a few hours. If we grow this organism as a biofilm for 2 days in the colony biofilm and then move it to a plate containing the same concentration of rifampin as used in the planktonic studies, we get, even over 2 days of continuous exposure, only a dent in the population. So this is the sort of tolerance that we're up against, I think, in vivo, and that we can capture very easily with simple in vitro models as well. On the next slide, you see some transmission electron micrographs from that same experiment with the Staph epi colony biofilm. On the left is the untreated control, and you can see, again, these morphologically normal cocci. Some of them are septating. This is out, both of these images are actually out at the air interface of the colony, so the upper right-hand corner of the image is the top kind of air interface. Now, over on the right, you see an image from a rifampin-treated colony biofilm, and what's immediately evident here is that the antibiotic has been here and been at work. There's a lower cell density, and there's what looks like evidence of cell lysis, and the remaining cells have thickened cell walls. So if you're following the geometry here, what this is telling us is that the antibiotic penetrated again. It had to, for me to get this picture on the right, the rifampin had to come up out of the auger, through the membrane, all the way through the colony biofilaments, about 100 microns thick, and then act on bacteria at the distal edge of the biofilm along the air interface. Now, the interesting thing is that if we scroll down into a middle layer of this colony biofilm, we can find the antibiotic treated colony biofilm, we can find bacteria that look just like the ones on the left, right? They're morphologically, they don't show any evidence of having been affected by the antibiotic. And what that suggests is that there's a physiological heterogeneity within this biofilm. On the next slide, you see a demonstration of exactly this kind of heterogeneity. So this is a frozen cross-section through one of these staph epi colony biofilms, and it's been probed with a technique that allows us to light up in green regions of the biofilm where the bacteria are engaging in active DNA synthesis. So the red is just a counterstain for all biomass, and so immediate impression here is that these are stripy, highly stratified, highly heterogeneous activity patterns. There's a band of activity, a prominent band of activity along the air interface, but there's also a sketchier, thinner band of activity along the membrane or nutrient interface, and then there's the middle part of the biofilm, actually probably the majority of the biofilm, the red region, in which we're not detecting any or very little replicative activity. And those cells in the middle, we think, are mostly viable, but just inactive. And those are the ones that are going to be very difficult to kill with an antibiotic. On the next slide, you see an oxygen profile in the same colony biofilm system. So this is the same technology that used to measure hydrogen peroxide a few slides ago, but now the electrode is engineered to detect oxygen. And we're coming down from the top of this colony biofilm, and within about 50 microns down, the oxygen is gone. All right, so bacteria at the along the air edge there are respiring oxygen, consuming it as it diffuses in, and creating this oxygen shadow or anoxic niche further down the biofilm. This oxic zone here corresponds pretty well with that top bright green stripe in the previous image, and oxygen is a key kind of environmental parameter here, helping us understand the heterogeneity in activity. And the next slide summarizes in this particular model system, but I suspect this is true in quite a variety of biofilms. So in these colony biofilms, we think that there are at least four cells in at least four different states, growing aerobically, growing fermentatively, in the absence of oxygen, a few dead cells, probably about 10%, and then a large population of dormant cells, bacteria that are not anabolically active, and again, those are going to be bacteria that are likely much less susceptible to antibiotics. Advancing to the next slide, I just want to show you a couple more colorful images from other biofilm systems, different reactors, and different bacteria that reinforce this message of microscale heterogeneity in the physiological status and activity of the cells. This is a Klebsiella pneumoniae biofilm, again seen in cross-section. The steel slide that it was grown on would have been down at the bottom. The nutrient medium carrying the carbon source and oxygen would have been at the top flowing over this biofilm. And I'm not going to explain the technique here, but the red-orange color corresponds to bacteria that are growing rapidly, and the yellow-greenish color corresponds to bacteria that are growing slowly or not at all. And you can see here that there's a band of active growth that tracks the biofilm bulk fluid interface. Where the biofilm is thin, for example, right there in the very center of this slide, the whole biofilm can be active, but where it gets thicker, we have interior regions that are look to be growing very slowly or perhaps not at all. And on the next slide, there's an example with a Pseudomonas aeruginosa biofilm probed for protein synthetic activity using an inducible green fluorescent protein construct. So this is actually in the capillary flow cell system again. And what we see is that in the larger clusters, that the protein synthetic activity is localized around the periphery of the cell cluster, where the bacteria have access to oxygen and nutrients. In the interior of the cluster, the red stain region, there's very little activity. So this kind of heterogeneity is a common, if perhaps ubiquitous, feature of mature biofilms of all different types of microbes. On the next slide, I just want to talk about a way to take this down to the genetic level. And here what I've done is to survey the literature, again, for this particular bacterium, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, for studies of the genes that are differentially regulated between biofilm and planktonic state. And this is based on 10 studies, half of them transcriptomic, half of them proteomic. And on the next slide, you see the top 26 genes that appear on multiple of these lists, right? So these are consensus genes that are expressed in Pseudomonas aeruginosa biofilms. And of course, these numbers may not mean anything to you, so I'm going to interpret for you on the next slide what these 26 genes actually indicate. And listed here are different activities that I have compared lists, independent lists of an activity such as an oxygen downshift with that list of biofilm consensus genes, and I'm asking if there's an enrichment of that gene set in the biofilm. And everything above the dashed line is potentially enriched. In fact, the things that stand out very strongly are oxygen limitation. So two different studies done two different ways, completely independent, these done with planktonic cells. We find many of those same genes up in the biofilm. Again, oxygen limitation, stationary phase, so bacteria slowing down their growth, and that one comes up, a little bit of indication of phenazine biosynthesis in some of these, and a marginal oxidative stress response. Then there's activities, those below the dashed line, that don't show up on this consensus list, including things like homoserine lactone quorum sensing. It's been talked about a lot, but I can't demonstrate it that those genes are statistically significantly enriched in the biofilm list. The point of this is that right here at the genetic level, we can find additional evidence for oxygen limitation and for slow growth or stationary phase character in the biofilm population. On the next slide, labeled adaptive stress response, I want to just mention one other protective mechanism that I think can be a part of the biofilm defense, and this is the possibility that the bacteria in a biofilm can actually implement an active response to an antimicrobial treatment. So on the left here, we see a brownish cell in an unstressed and presumably relatively susceptible state, but upon exposure to antimicrobial, has to be a sublethal exposure, those bacteria can turn on new genes and stress responses to become less susceptible and enter this green state where they're going to be harder to kill. On the next slide, we see an example of exactly this phenomenon, and this is back to the biofilm that was being treated with hydrogen peroxide. In fact, this is from that same thesis student's work. And what you're seeing in red there is a reporter gene for the CATB gene in Pseudomonas aeruginosa. This is the inducible catalase enzyme in this organism. And when this biofilm is hit with hydrogen peroxide at starting at 0 minutes here, the bacteria are actually able to turn this gene on and make this enzyme. If we do the same exact experiment with the same reporter construct strain with a free-floating or planktonic cell, we put them in a test tube, we add, and this is again 50 millimolar hydrogen peroxide, we get a flat line, that blue trace at the bottom there. And what I think is happening here is that the planktonic cells are dying faster than they can deploy the oxidative stress response. The concentration of hydrogen peroxide that we're using here, 50 millimolar, is a few orders of magnitude higher than is typically used by investigators studying oxidative stress in bacteria. So it's a very aggressive kind of flamethrower level of hydrogen peroxide, and it overwhelms the planktonic cells, and they just are knocked dead. In the biofilm, these other protective mechanisms, such as slow penetration or slow growth, buy a little bit of time and actually allow at least some of the bacteria in the biofilm to deploy this active defense against peroxide. So on the next slide is a summary about what I've told you about biofilms and chronic infections, that there's evidence for biofilms in very diverse, slow-moving but persistent infections. The classic examples are those associated with indwelling devices such as catheters and prosthetic joints. These share common characteristics. One of the very important ones is that when microorganisms band together in a biofilm, they become protected from killing by all types of antimicrobial agents, really right across the spectrum from reactive oxidants like chlorine, bleach, all the way out to antibiotics that have very exquisitely specific cellular targets. And what I hope you take away from the kind of science discussion here is that there are likely multiple protective mechanisms that overlap and work synergistically to protect the bacteria in a biofilm. On the last slide here, you see an image of the Center for Biofilm Engineering at Montana State University, and there's quite a bit of blue sky and puffy bacterial-shaped clouds sailing overhead at the center these days still. And I invite you to visit our website for excellent resources about biofilms, and to, if you're from industry in particular, to check out our Industrial Associates program, and certainly to contact us if you'd like to learn more. We aim to be a hub in the biofilm world, not just for medical biofilms, but for biofilms in environmental engineering, in biofuels, in drinking water, and many, many other engineered applications. Thank you very much for tuning in to the seminar today. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Phil, for that extremely comprehensive review of the manifestations of biofilms in humans and the science behind their continued success against our efforts to combat them. I wonder if I could just ask you to comment really on the use of iodine and silver on biofilm, whether you feel that they would be effective then, because you demonstrated that many other agents aren't that effective.
I think like every other antimicrobial out there, we'll find that iodine and silver are less effective against bacteria in a biofilm compared to the same organism when it's grown in free suspension. So, you know, that'll be the same. That doesn't mean that they're not useful still, right? You have to, you know, we still want to do something to suppress the biofilm. There's a huge interest these days in silver in medical applications, coating various forms of silver onto catheters or devices to, you know, hopefully kind of set up a preventative effect. And, you know, some of those seem to have some efficacy. I don't think that's necessarily tomorrow's technology, but it may have a place.
Yeah, sure. I think the thing is prevent the biofilm from forming in the first place rather than try and sort it out afterwards, I think. Well, thanks very much again for that, Phil. If you've enjoyed today's teleclass, there are 37 teleclasses left this year, so a lot of quality education to come on the Weber Training website. But wherever you are in the world, I hope you've enjoyed this session, and a very good day to you all.